Can I open the House Committee on Land Use? Today is March 14th, 2013. Going to open a... this is not my agenda for today. Sorry. It's like I was going to open a work session on something. That's not... Let me open a work session on House Bill 3087. Committee members, we have not heard this bill, but one of my vice chairs and I, sorry, Vice Chair Frederick, talked about this. This bill really doesn't have any land use implications per se. It's kind of a fee bill, and so the request is with no recommendation to move it to judiciary so they can discuss it along with their other fees in court and in judicial proceeding bills. Not that we need less bills, but it's...
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3087 to House Judiciary Committee without recommendation.
Yeah. Vice Chair Cameron moves House Bill 3087 without recommendation to the Judiciary Committee. Any discussion? Representative Thatcher.
No. Sorry, I was just motioning somebody just to give me a minute.
Sorry.
It's just bad timing here.
Sorry.
Yeah.
any other or any discussion? Okay. Seeing that none, does the clerk have to call the roll?
Okay.
Will the clerk please call? No?
Oh, I don't have to.
Okay. Any objections to? Okay. Moving to judiciary. Close the work session on House Bill 3087.
Yeah. We just asked for objections.
And let's open up for Representative Conger. I thought I saw him.
Oh, yep. Some water.
Okay.
Chairman.
We're just going to slowly open a work session. Oh, no, a public hearing. Sorry. On House Bill.
Gosh.
Some heart flutters there in the audience. 3362. Public hearing on House Bill 3362. Right now. You're so charming. We want to.
Let's take a vote on that.
We want to hear about it.
Not just avoiding the testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jason Conger, representing House District 54, and appreciate very much the opportunity to be heard on this bill. I think the basic premise here is looking for every way we possibly can to make government processes more efficient, ideally local, so there's more contact between decision makers and those who are interested in the outcomes. Land use, of course, I'm sure that there are people who land on both sides of this, but certainly my perception is that there's a lot of inefficiency in the land use process. And to the extent we can find ways to reduce delay, increase certainty for people who are looking for decisions on land use, I think that's a worthy goal. The concept behind House Bill 3362 is, and by the way, you can call up the rest of the panel with me if you want to.
Okay. We've got one gentleman on the phone coming in.
Yeah, whenever you want to.
That's Damian Smirnick. But otherwise, the panel is Doug Riggs and Aaron Doyle? Or,
yes.
And then Damian on the phone? Does that sound right? Okay. We'll try and dial Damian here. We kind of wanted to grill you when you didn't have any help to answer questions. That's not fair.
That thought had entered my head, so reinforcements quickly. Did you see the little panic light flashing in the corner of my eye?
Yeah.
Hello, this is Damian. Can I help you?
Damian, hi. This is Lynn Beaton from the committee.
Hi, good morning. Or good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. You're on as a member of the first panel.
Okay.
And so if you can just hang for just a minute and listen, and you'll be invited to testify in just a minute.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Jason Conger. This House Bill 3362 would align one part of the land use process with several other parts. This is obviously dealing with the legislative part of land use, and we'll hear more specifics about that, but it would align it more with other quasi-judicial aspects of the land use laws, and which in some sense I think the way I describe it is streamlining the process in one way, which is requiring that issues that would be raised on appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals regarding a land use decision have to be raised in the local hearing process at the point where the local decision maker is making the decision. In my mind, that's a very good thing for a couple of reasons. One, it does allow a greater degree of certainty for the applicant for the land use decision. But it's also good because it gives the local decision-making body and the local community an opportunity to address the issue. And if it's not raised at the local level, then that opportunity never exists. And instead, things that might be better resolved in a way that could be more ideal for the community and for the particular situation aren't, and they get resolved instead at the state level at the Land Use Board of Appeals, which takes more time, involves more cost, creates more uncertainty, and it is a less than ideal result. So I know there are some concerns that have been raised about it. Hopefully I've given at least a sense of what the bill does. The bill is actually very simple. That's all it does is require that issues that are going to be raised on appeal have been raised in the local decision-making process. Some of the concerns that I had heard, and I thought I wrote them down and brought them with me, I wanted to just respond to them because there's actually a couple that I saw yesterday that are probably legitimate. So these are in opposition and in a response. The current context for applying a raise it or waive it standard, which is what we're trying to apply through House Bill 3362, are quasi-judicial hearings conducted in accordance with procedures under ORS 197763. House Bill 3362 possibly could be amended to ensure that the same standards apply in these legislative decision-making processes to public hearings conducted by planning commissions and elected bodies on legislative amendments. There's also a legitimate issue raised regarding how to identify and direct testimony to the applicable criteria. The list of criteria that may be applicable can be quite lengthy for legislative decisions and include sometimes goals, statutes, administrative rules, and local decision-making criteria. We could probably work on House Bill 3362 to better identify the applicable criteria and communicate it to citizens about how to direct their testimony in such a way that to the criteria and that they believe may be applicable. And then the last issue that I had seen that had been raised as a concern to me is the issue of notice. And in the quasi-judicial decisions, notice is mailed to the owners of properties surrounding the property that would be affected by the decision. Legislative notice is posted in a newspaper, provided to DLCD, and possibly posted on the local government entity's website. It might be, probably would be desirable to talk about having a more direct notice to those who would be immediately impacted, meaning the neighbors, like the quasi-judicial process. And with that, I am happy to answer any questions, especially the easy ones.
Would you like to, I don't know your schedule, would you like us to do questions for you first or let the panel talk, or what's your, maybe?
I'm good till 3:30, so I'm happy to stay. And
okay, why don't we do a few questions now, though, Representative Davis?
Thank you, Representative Conger, and thank you, Chair. Could you talk more generally about why this is important, or you see it as important within the context of our sort of broader? I know this isn't a judicial decision, but our judicial system, sort of the history of you know, American notice requirements. I draw a parallel to normal appeals, where it would seem strange, I think, for an attorney to be able to raise an issue on appeal that hadn't been raised on a lower level.
That's actually a great question, and I did not provide it for Representative Davis, who is a fellow attorney. And going back in time to the very beginning of American legal history,
I thought you might really do it. Okay, you got till 3:30, I guess. So.
I believe in a system that provides people with notice who might have an interest in outcomes in decision-making processes, and that would include, of course, dispute resolution processes, which is the quasi-judicial in land use or the judicial that Representative Davis is asking about. And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I should have responded properly.
Fine.
The ideal situation would be one where everybody who has a concern or could have a concern about a decision that's being made, especially to the extent that they're possibly immediately impacted by it directly or indirectly, would be that they know that it's coming and they know where to go to weigh in on it. We have notice requirements. We have to post notice of our hearings, and we have to follow those because we want people to come in and be able to weigh in during the process, and we have an interest in that because we get a better outcome in the legislation. I think it's similar in land use decisions. The way the current system works in this situation that we're trying to address here is that you can have an entire local land use process run its course, and then my understanding, I don't have any data to back this up, but I'll say it anyway. Lots of stuff gets said like that in this building, is that if you did that, I think you would try to address all of the concerns. And then if someone had felt like the outcome was wrong, they could appeal it, but you would have tried to address it. Now, a lot of times, attorneys for interest groups not representing local people who were actually impacted directly by the decision will bring an appeal, and they are not limited to what was discussed and resolved or not resolved at the local level. That means that on the side of the applicant, the one who is trying to go through the process for this kind of decision, this kind of land use decision, as well as the local government, they don't have any idea where the process terminates. So they might think they've addressed everything. They might have done just a yeoman's job of notice and getting people in, and they might have had a robust hearing and worked out a compromise and made the decision, but that's not the end of the story, because now, regardless of whether or not the issue was raised, regardless of whether or not anyone was even aware of the issue, there's this opportunity to appeal, stretch out the process, create uncertainty, delay, cost, and it doesn't have to come from, and I don't think we should be under any illusion that it comes from, concerns always that exist in the community, or concerns that couldn't have been addressed if those issues were raised during the local decision-making process.
Follow up. So drawing a parallel, in our process, in this body, we have to raise issues in committee. And then once a measure, a bill gets to the floor, unless that measure was discussed in committee, we can't raise that on the floor. That's my understanding of our rules.
For minority reports.
For minority reports.
People raise everything on the floor randomly.
Almost not appropriate.
We had that consent count.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But that's because the decision hasn't been made yet.
Right.
What you can't do is you can't come back after the fact, after we've gaveled down on the floor on a vote on a bill, and say, whoops, wait a minute, I move we undo that vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because we have a process that gets to an end decision. Now, the decision might be right or wrong, but because we have a process, we know how it works, and we know we need to get in there and get our concern addressed, really at the committee level, but we need to get it addressed before the votes are taken. And again, that doesn't mean that every bill is perfect. Almost every bill is perfect, but my bills are always perfect. It doesn't mean that every bill is perfect, but there's certainty in that process, and I take a lot of comfort in that, because the bottom line is, I might think a bill is perfect, and I might vote yes on it. You might think a bill is not perfect, and whoever gets the most votes knows that they win. Now, you get to come back next session and take a crack at changing it, and that's also good. But we at least know that there's an end, and if you want to change it during the process, you know where you have to do it. And that kind of certainty, I think, is very important to people's perception of fairness in the process and our confidence that our processes actually work, value our input, even though we might not win all the time or our view might not prevail.
Anything else for Representative Conger before we move on to the other folks?
Okay.
Thank you.
Escaped pretty lightly. Not bad.
Look forward to that work session.
All right. We'll talk. Damien. So, Damien, you're on.
Oh, thank you, Chair Klebb. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Damien Cernick. For the record, let me spell my name because I know it's hard to spell and pronounce unless you see it at the same time. First name, Damien, D-A-M-I-A-N. Last name, S-Y-R-N-Y-K. I'm a senior planner for the city of Bend, and my address here in Bend is 710 Northwest Wall Street, 97701. Thank you for allowing me to testify remotely today. I owe Lynn and Andra a debt of gratitude for allowing me to do this. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3362. I'll apologize at the beginning of my testimony because I will be using a number of acronyms that I will spell out first so that we're all on the same page. And I've already provided Lynn with testimony that provides some background on what the City of Bend and COCO are trying to accomplish with the bill. As I outlined in my written testimony, this is a bill intended to address what issues are raised before the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA, in their review of legislative land use decisions. And the category of legislative decisions that I'll be referring to today are those that are called post-acknowledgement plan amendments. And the cute acronym for these is PAPAs. These are amendments that a local government, either a city or a county, will consider once their comprehensive plan and implementing regulations are adopted. And as I mentioned, it's a bill intended to address decisions made by either city or county. There's no limitations or issues regarding size or location. And what we're trying to accomplish through this bill is to, I think as Representative Conger pointed out, try to know what those issues are that will be raised on appeal before LUBA after a local government has made a decision on a PAPA, so we can avoid surprises. I think what we're trying to do is ensure that when LUBA hears an appeal, they're going to be deciding the issue where a local government's made a decision and the citizens disagreed with that, and they're not acting to review new evidence or a new issue that hasn't really been raised below before the local government, and where we have not had an opportunity to respond to it and try to resolve it. What we're not trying to do, and I don't think the bill does this, is limit someone standing before LUBA. So there's nothing in the bill that would preclude somebody from appealing a decision to LUBA. What we're really trying to focus on are those issues that would be raised before the local government so that, as I said, we know what to expect if there's an appeal to LUBA. We can use LUBA for that. Their purpose for which they were formed so they can review decisions and determine whether we've satisfied the law. And I understand that Representative Conger also raised what we've heard outside of the hearing today are some of the concerns people have that I want to elaborate on what he's said already in a couple of points. One is that the raise it or waive it standard that already exists in statute has been paired with procedures for conducting quasi-judicial hearings. And these are hearings that are conducted on certain land use decisions like a subdivision plot or a conditional use. One of the important differences, as he pointed out, is that the notice requirements are different for a quasi-judicial matter. They are mailed to the owner of property within a certain distance of a proposal. The notice describes the applicable criteria, which often may not change after a notice has been sent out, and identifies the proposal that's being considered. And this is a legitimate issue because for legislative hearings, it's common for a proposal to start at one point and get modified to the process, and those modifications may raise situations where you need to address newer different standards. He also brought up the issue of notice in terms of how it's provided, and I think we're also open to talking about how we could do a better job of trying to notify citizens about when a local government is considering a zoning code amendment, what the nature of it is, and so that we can do a better job of communicating and then facilitating that communication process so that they can provide comments and direct comments towards applicable criteria. So that concludes my oral testimony. You've got my March 12th letter. I just wanted to wrap up by saying thanks again for letting me participate this way. It's a full-day drive to and from Salem, and so it saves me from doing that, but also being able to participate. Thank you again for the opportunity, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Let's do questions for Damian so he can get off the phone if he wants to, or you're welcome to listen to the rest of the hearing, whatever you prefer. I guess you can do that online, too. Questions for Damian. Okay. Damian, did you know you really don't have any real vowels in your last name?
I got a part-time vowel in my last name.
Yeah, sometimes why.
Sometimes why. It's just repeated.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling in, and we can either keep you on the phone or you can listen online for the rest of it, whatever you prefer.
I'll be happy to stay on the line as long as the hearing's going on and then be available for any questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whoever would you like to go next?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. We are also here in favor of House Bill 3362 because we do think that it is most appropriate to make land use decisions at the local level. The purpose and intent behind this bill is to ensure that there is that local process that addresses all the issues of concern and avoids and time-consuming and sometimes expensive appeal on issues that would probably have been more appropriate to raise at the local level, but also the tactic of surprise appeals, basically where a city has addressed five issues from one concerned party, and then upon appeal they find out there were really 10. Addressing that before LUBA is inefficient, and it also cuts other citizens out of that process that might be able to chime in or have an opinion on those same issues of concern at the local level. Therefore, the raise it or waive it standard is really important as far as making sure that things start at the lowest and cheapest level to address those citizens address those concerns where the process is really in place to have that interactive conversation between the land use decision makers and the folks affected by them. And so by having this raise it or waive it standard with an appeal to LUBA, just is one more way of ensuring that we're not wasting resources arguing about things that we could have done earlier in the process and more efficiently with more involvement and the actual folks who understand the character and development of a local plan better. as opposed to kicking it up to a board of attorneys who have a statewide perspective but not a local perspective. And for that reason, we support this bill. We understand that there are probably some necessary amendments that have to happen, and we'll be happy to work on those to make sure that the process remains fair to all the parties who are concerned, not just cities and not just folks trying to appeal. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Hey, Doug.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Doug Riggs with the Central Oregon Cities Organization. We represent 9 cities in Deschutes, Crook, and Jefferson County, including Redmond, Sisters, Maupin, Bend, Metolius, Lapine, Madras, Culver, and Prineville, and we're very happy to be here today. Very much appreciate you taking the time. I know you've heard a lot about this. I'm just going to raise 4 quick points and then be available to answer questions. The first point is that what this is really getting at is an opportunity to hopefully streamline and make the land use process a little more efficient, both for local governments and local citizens. Aligning the 2 sections that already exist that use this procedure, 197.763, along with 197.195, and then the post-acknowledgement plan amendment section that we're talking about, makes the process consistent, and it also allows the local government to skip that very expensive step, hopefully down the line, that costs millions of dollars and leads to extensive delays. In our region, we've seen cities held up a year or more because of an appeal on an issue that wasn't raised at the local level. For a city to have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars addressing an issue that would have been better addressed at the local level is costly and inefficient. The second concern that's been raised that I don't think was raised here today is if you open the bill and take a look at the last page, Section 4 has some language that Legislative Council inserted. This was a pre-session filed bill that we came up with back in July, August, and September. And Section 4 could conceivably be read to reopen the entire Goal 1 process, which I think the department will get up and consider perhaps burdensome on the department. We would have no problem removing that entire section. We don't think it's important to the bill, and so to the extent that it helps allay any concerns about DLCD or LCDC processes, we would be happy to see that section deleted. The third point I want to make is one that I've already made, which this is a process that already exists in 197.763. It exists in 197.195. There are notice procedures that are slightly different in those 2 provisions that we would be happy to work to incorporate into this section. But my point is that this change is not, it's neither a new nor a radical concept. This is something that has been used before. And my final point along this line is that in essence, what we're trying to do with this section is not only make the process more efficient and hopefully reduce costs and delay in the long term, but give citizens an opportunity to be properly noticed, to get involved, and to have an opportunity to sit down, as Aaron said, at the local level, in a local community, with a process where they can participate in the discussion and the decision-making process in their community. I would argue that forcing a citizen to make an appeal and drive all the way to Salem and sit through LUBA hearings, maybe hire an probably hire an attorney, and get involved in trying to modify a city or a county decision at that point is inefficient not only for the local government but also for the citizen from that community. So I think it's incumbent upon cities to make sure that we properly notice citizens, that we get people involved in the local land use process. My 9 cities, and I think the AOC and the LOC are committed to see that happen, and we're perfectly willing to modify the bill to make sure that that notice procedure is appropriate. But again, the effort here is to make, in a very difficult economic time with cities facing severe budget crises, to try to make the process a little more streamlined in a few cases, and that's the goal for today. So thank you very much.
Okay, any question for these 3? Damien's still with us, I think. Representative Thatcher.
I guess just one. Have you already been in discussion about specific amendment language, and how soon will we see that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thatcher, yes, we have had those conversations. This bill was pre-session filed. It popped out at the beginning of the session. Of course, opposition doesn't circulate until the bill is posted for a hearing. And so just in the last couple of days, we've seen a number of memos from a variety of people. Damian and I have both had conversations with those interest groups and also with the department. And so I would say that based on what we hear today, my goal would be to get a note to go to LC and make some changes in the bill and then hopefully come back with something that would be more acceptable. I'm not sure we'll get 100% in agreement, but I think we can address some of the serious concerns that we've heard in the last couple of days.
Okay. I think we're done with this panel. Now to hear more about local input, because that's the only thing she ever talks to me about. Peggy Lynch, could you please come forward? And how about Steve McCoy and Paul Dewey?
And Damian, can you mute your phone from your end?
Yes.
Great. And then if we need you, we'll ask you to unmute yourself. Thanks.
I'll call you Mrs. Local. Miss Local, whatever you prefer.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I don't have written testimony for you. I'm sorry. You all are just moving much too fast for me. So I want to make sure that people understand how the system works, and I think Damian actually did sort of a good job of trying to explain some of it. But the truth is that quasi-judicial hearings, you get a notice in the mail that something's happening near you or in your community or your citizen organization, and then you get an opportunity to learn more about what the issue is and exactly what the criteria is for making the decision, and you can provide the raise it or waive it issue. With legislative matters, there is just maybe a notice in the paper. So should something like this go forward, I would assume that the local government would need to provide an individual notice for every legislative action to every citizen in their area. Back in 1998, the voters of Oregon passed Measure 56, which required a notice if a land use action was going to perhaps affect their property. And for a number of years, the state was burdened with the cost of those notices. As I quickly looked in the budgets, the last time I think DLCD had a budget for those notices was for $90,000 in the 2009-11 budget. They don't have any money in their budget for this session, but they were the ones required to repay the local jurisdiction for those notices. So that's the first thing, and the quick thing that I noticed in this bill is that, frankly, if you're going to ask legislative matters to be a raise it or waive it issue, then every citizen needs to know what's going on. John Chandler and I have sat together many times wanting to make sure that citizens know about planning stuff at that stage during the legislative process. It is the most important thing. It is when policy is made. It's like you, when you make your laws, you do the most important thing to what happens to our lives. And if citizens don't know what you're doing in this building, it's really sad, because they need to know and be able to share with you what the issues are that are important to them. So I loved Section 4. I was sorry to hear that Doug didn't want us to take it out. For years, many of us have asked LCDC to do Goal 1 rulemaking to increase the opportunity for citizens to know about our land use system and to be actively participating in the development of the plans for their community. So I'm sure that there are many more technical things that I could offer, but those are, since 1972, I have been doing land use, and my focus has always been citizen participation and citizen involvement. I served as the chair of the Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee for LCDC for a few years, and in my local community. Citizen involvement is really important to me, and having citizens engaged and helping their community is really important to me. Appeals are maybe 1% of the system. We hear the tragedy of how burdensome appeals are, but they are a very small number of the total number of applications and actions related to land use. So I'm very interested in section number 4, but the rest of it, I think, is not something that I would recommend and I would oppose. Thank you.
Okay. Let me just take a look here. Steve, I got you next.
Great. Excuse me. Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I am testifying in opposition to HB 3362. Goal 1 of Oregon's land use program is citizen involvement. Oregon's land use program is enforced by concerned citizens, not by DLCD, not by the state, not by local governments, by concerned citizens. Without the ability to enforce the land use laws, they are rendered void. The ability to enforce is integral to citizen involvement and to goal one. I'm going to get a little wonky here and talk a little bit about quasi-judicial decisions versus legislative decisions. I saw you look at the clock.
Okay. Doing some math in my head here.
Yeah, yeah. I'll make it quick.
Okay, no, you're fine.
Okay. The Supreme Court set out a three-part test to determine what a quasi-judicial decision was in the Strawberry Hill four-wheelers decision. And it's three parts. First, does the process once begun call for reaching a decision with that decision being confined by pre-existing criteria rather than...
Could you push the mic back away from you just a little bit?
Sure.
It's throwing us off here.
Oh, sorry.
Audio. It's okay.
Rather than like a wide-ranging discretionary choice. So more complex decisions that are discretionary are likely legislative. So big decisions, discretionary decisions, are legislative. Second, to what extent is the decision maker bound to apply pre-existing criteria to concrete facts? So legislative decisions, those would be quasi-judicial ones that have specific criteria and concrete facts. So we're talking about, again, not simple application of facts to law. We're talking about complexities. We're talking about discretion. And third, to what extent is the decision directed at a closely circumscribed factual situation or a relatively small number of persons? So that's quasi-judicial, smaller number of people, smaller situations. Legislative are large numbers of people that are affected, large situations. So, for example, a decision on a permit application is generally quasi-judicial, while a decision, for example, changing what uses are allowed in a particular zone, that would be more of a legislative one. So that goes back to what Peggy was talking about with notice, that it's easy to notify the neighbors of a quasi-judicial decision because it's only affecting a small number of properties, while legislative decisions can affect every property in the local jurisdiction. So why am I talking about quasi-judicial and legislative? Because there's a crucial difference in standing between the two at LUBA for quasi-judicial versus legislative decisions. Raise it or waive it is the doctrine that says issues must be raised in front of the local government or they cannot be appealed to LUBA. Raise it or waive it is, of course, required in quasi-judicial matters and not in legislative matters. For all changes, both quasi-judicial and legislative, notice goes to parties that have requested notice from DLCD, and it's posted on DLCD's website. Major changes must be reported to DLCD 10 days before the final hearing. But in part because of raise it or waive it, the notice requirements are much different for quasi-judicial. Not a little different, a lot different. Notice is required to people within a certain distance. It's required to neighborhood organizations. And the notice must contain or must explain the nature of the application and the proposed use or uses which could be authorized, list the plan criteria that apply to the decision, property address, date, time, and location of a hearing, mailed at least 20 days before the hearing, include the name of a local government representative they can contact, general explanation of the requirements for submission of testimony, and also the a preliminary record must be available that includes a copy of the application and all documents and evidence submitted to support the application, as well as a copy of the staff report. None of that, none of those notice requirements exist for legislative decisions, and that information is often not available. It's not required to be available and is often not available for legislative decisions. So it's much more difficult to track what's going on with legislative decisions than it is with quasi-judicial decisions. Also, with quasi-judicial decisions, continuances are required to be granted. So if somebody says, gosh, I need seven more days to get my comments into you, they get seven more days to get their comments in. And none of these things are required for legislative amendments, even though they're the big decisions. They're the ones that affect a lot of people. They're the ones that affect large amounts of land. They are the ones that are discretionary. Not only that, there are commonly last-minute changes to legislative decisions based upon citizen input. That's a great thing, frankly, that if changes are made to legislative decisions based upon citizen input, that's where we want to get to, frankly. But generally, there won't be an opportunity, since you don't get the continuance, there won't be an opportunity to register written objections to the last-minute changes. Mr. Smirnick talked about surprises. Surprises go both ways here. Another thing is, I mentioned that the record, or preliminary record, essentially, is required to be kept for the, and to be available, I should say, for quasi-judicial decisions and not for legislative. Appeals deal with the application of law to the facts. So having the law separated from the facts does no good. The record is the facts. The record is not available until 21 days after a notice of intent to appeal is filed with LUBA. So it's difficult in legislative situations to have the facts necessary to know what you need to raise. Legislative and quasi-judicial decisions are just different animals. Applying raise it or waive it to quasi-judicial decisions that are much larger, more complicated, affect more people. They're harder to monitor. They're susceptible to last-minute change. This would just take away citizens' opportunity to enforce the land use program. For these reasons, we ask you to oppose HB 3362. Thank you.
Paul.
Chair Clam, good to see you again.
You too.
Committee members, my name is Paul Dewey. I drove over from Bend this afternoon. I'm the attorney and executive director for an organization called Central Oregon Land Watch. It was formed in the early 80s. We have a record of over 25 years. We have several hundred members. Representative Conger referred to attorneys for interest groups not representing local people. We are the local people over there. We focus on Jefferson County, Crook County, and Deschutes County, a little bit into Klamath County. We're just a local organization with local members. I wanted to testify today on this matter. Actually, I just pretty much found out about it yesterday. But when I heard that Damien was going to be testifying, actually, I just read his letter of March 12, 2 minutes ago. And so I wanted to respond to the concerns that folks are not raising issues or not trying to raise issues, because we have tried. And one of the examples that Damien mentioned in his letter regarding a recent water public facilities plan for the city of Bend, I did a quick letter for you, and I've attached comments that we submitted. In the letter, Damien, to you, Damien mentions that there were two issues that LUBA remanded that had the city known we were going to be raising those issues, they could have addressed them. And what I've done is attach comments we submitted to the local record where we did, in fact, raise those two issues. And I've attached comments or findings from city staff where they acknowledged that we raised those two issues. But let me give you an example of where this gets a little bit complex. One of the issues we raised back in November of 2011 was that the city was improperly including water service outside of the urban growth boundary. And this was a matter that LCDC had ruled upon in a recent proposal to expand Bend's urban growth boundary, where the city impermissibly attempted to have a plan both inside and outside the UGB. And basically, Goal 11 pretty much requires that infrastructure development for cities occur obviously inside urban growth boundaries, not outside in rural areas where it encourages sprawl. And it looked to us like the city was proposing a water public facilities plan for development outside the urban growth boundary. And as you'll see on the bottom of page 4 of my letter back in November of 2011, we pointed out that this analysis for a system that extends beyond the UGB is not permitted by Goal 11. 6 months later, the city responded to our letter just before the Bend City Council approved the Water Public Facilities Plan. And in its findings, the city said, the only service improvements to areas outside the UGB are to those areas that are already served, including the inn at the Seventh Mountain and Widgie Creek. That was the representation, inn at the Seventh Mountain and Widgie Creek. The City Council approved the Water Public Facilities Plan. We filed a notice of intent to appeal for a variety of issues. And once we started looking at the record, once the record was produced and we could look at what was in the record, we found that, well, actually Tethero Destination Resort was going to be receiving improvements outside the urban growth boundary, not just in the Seventh Mountain or Widgie Creek. And so if we were held to a standard of raise it or waive it, we didn't raise the problem of service to Tethero because we hadn't really seen that. And the staff didn't refer to it. The staff said it was going to be the inn of the Seventh Mountain in Widgie Creek. And so not until we got the record and studied it more did we understand that Tethero Destination Resort was going to be receiving expanded service. And when we raised it on appeal, LUBA ruled in our favor and remanded it back to the city to be corrected. Now, the irony here, as it turns out, because we just finished the remand proceedings, is that the Public Works Department had given the planning staff of the city of Bend wrong information, that actually the Tethero development had already happened. It happened years before. So, in fact, the public facilities plan wasn't going to be providing information to Tethero. So the city's misrepresentation here was actually correct, accidentally. But it shows what we go through when we're reviewing these legislative matters. It's not until we can really examine the full record that we can understand what issues to raise on appeal. And it was a good issue to raise on appeal. We were affirmed by LUBA, and LUBA sent it back. And, you know, the source of this was just the city hadn't done it right. But because of our appeal, the city has been forced to do it right. But what we face more often than not with legislative matters is what we refer locally affectionately to document dumps that often happen in legislative proceedings when just minutes, sometimes minutes before a record closes, the city introduces a ton of documents. And It's not malicious. They're trying to get all the documents into the record that they can get to uphold their decision, should it be appealed. But the public doesn't get a chance to even see some of these documents, let alone respond to them, before the record closes. And so it's fundamentally unfair to require a raise it or waive it standard in that context. And often the legislative body, after the record is closed, they'll make a change. There are substantial changes in the legislation. And again, we have no opportunity then to comment. I mean, our only opportunity is to raise an issue with LUBA. And LUBA's procedures are expedited. We have 21 days. They have 21 days to file the record. The city does. We have 21 days to file a brief. The other side has 21 days to file a brief. And LUBA's hearing this decision in probably 25, another 7 days after that. Decision comes out in 30 days. And then your remand issues are limited to the issues that LUBA has reversed the local government on. And so it's an expedited process. But if we were forced to raise it or waive it, to raise all the issues, we would miss a lot of the key issues that are really critical to good legislation. And what we're talking about is legislation here that affects a lot of cases. So it's really important to get it right. The other thing that we often run into is that a document, for example, in the Water Public Facilities Plan, the city incorporates by reference a variety of studies. Some of those studies can be hundreds of pages in length. And I mean, it's awkward because you don't really know what the legislation is until you then read through these voluminous reports. But that's really what we're dealing with here. And I think the system is working well. I mean, if this was dragging out for years in front of LUBA, that would be one thing. But what this is just providing is local citizens like us to really examine quite carefully what's involved. And oftentimes it's not conservation groups appealing like these Goal 11. It's like the Home Builders Association. The key case on Goal 11 was the Home Builders Association going after Lane County. So it's a mixture of interests, and I appreciate your forbearance. I'm sorry I've gone on so long, but thank you for listening. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Any questions for this panel? Representative Davis.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate your perspective on it, especially I think notice is embodied in our country, in our Constitution, and that process is important. And I'm thinking even the previous panel discussed creating a better way to do notice at the local level. So because I think we all might agree it would be better that some of these decisions be made at the local level if sufficient notice were provided. We talked about potentially sending a mailing out to every single resident. Well, we don't do that for our sort of legislation. We don't do that for lots of courts, court legislation. We don't do it for rulemaking from agencies. So I don't necessarily think that would be the route to go. But agency rulemaking, for example, is a good example of something where we do provide a example of what the agency rule might be, and then there's a protracted period of comment and discussion back and forth. So I suppose this is more of a comment that as we look at the land use system that we have, thinking about ways to make that notice period more effective so that you don't have those last-minute document dumps, you don't have last-minute gut and stuffs, which from the legislative perspective is always frustrating. And I would welcome ideas for how to make that the local part of this decision more open and fair to all parties.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I kind of like gun stuff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis.
Exactly.
I appreciate the idea that we want to make sure that citizens are involved. And I want to make another comment since you've heard things from a couple of lawyers here. The truth is, the last discussion was about whether or not Goal 11, which is a state goal, was used appropriately in this Bend case. So these citizens paid to enforce the state law. I would love it, frankly, if DLCD had the budget, and because they get notice of these, and would help enforce the state law so that those of us as citizens didn't have to spend our money and our time doing that. The other thing I do have as a concern is I don't want to slow down too much local government decisions because, again, there are so few appeals. And if, in fact, you slow down the legislative process and don't let them continue to get their work done, that's concerning to me, too. I want my local government to work. So we just have to be very careful if we try to address that issue. Thank you.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes, I'm going to ask you pretty much the same question I asked the last panel. Are you able to work out any agreement on any of the changes that are proposed in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, I love Section 4, but I'll tell you, but I will also be very honest and say that this session, due to the budget constraints, I don't know that I would burden DLCD's budget with Goal 1 rulemaking, but I would love it. The rest of it, I'm not really sure. I have had very little time to study the bill, be happy to work with people on it, but I'm just not sure that there is a real answer to what is really a very small problem. It's a very big problem if it's the appeal that you have to deal with. I don't deny that. And I'm sure the city of Bend feels it was a very, very big issue. But when you're looking at the scope of decisions that are made, it's a really small problem, and I'm not sure that we can find a solution. But I'd be happy to work on it. I love working on citizen involvement.
I noticed the one example that was in writing was about, I think it was about population forecasting, which we have another bill in front of us that would actually make it no longer go to LUBA and, you know, potentially help on that particular, you know, circumstance. It also obviously moves the population forecasting elsewhere other than to the county, so there's trade-offs. But
right, okay. We support that bill, by the way.
Okay. So you want to see amendments or just as is?
I want to see how you finally work it, but by and large, we support the concept of making sure that you have one answer related to population forecasting, that we don't have to bother with dueling.
I should never have asked that. Sorry, I've got a bunch of people, other bills. Sorry, I asked it. It's my fault.
I was going to say, okay. Point of order.
Yeah, sorry about that. No offense. Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's get the rest of our final group up. That's John Chandler, Mike Eliason, four, and Bob Rendy, neutral.
Is that allowed?
Yeah. Just didn't want to imply it was all for, if he's not supposed to say that.
Yeah.
Or against, or whatever he is. I'm not sure. Whoever he actually is, it's not on the paper, so we'll find out here in a moment from Bob. But let's hear from our proponents first, who have him surrounded.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. We do support House Bill 3362. In the interest of time, I'll simply adopt the comments of the proponents from our friends at the cities a little bit earlier and just simply say that we do believe that the local planning commission and boards and commissions, city councils are the best places to deal with these particular matters. At the same time, we'll acknowledge some of the concerns raised by the opponents on the notice provisions and citizen involvement, and certainly would be willing to work with all parties on trying to come up with appropriate notice standards for legislative matters. But we do support the bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, that's easy. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 3362 as well. I was actually having flashbacks in the back of the room there for some sessions back arguing about a different section of ORS 197, talking about notice and quasi-judicial decision-making, which is contained voluminously in 197.763. And I tried to get legislative counsel at that point to draft a bill for me that contained the phrase, may not lay in the weeds. Because really, that's what we're talking about here, is people laying in the weeds doing document dumps, either opponents or proponents of a particular measure. And I know if we'd have put that in the statute, everybody would have known exactly what we meant, and we would have fixed the problem, but legislative counsel wouldn't draft that for me. You heard from both sides that there are problems here. They may not crop up all that often, but when they do, they're a mess. And somehow getting beyond the fiction of our people are paying attention to local land use issues because our system depends upon public input, public involvement, goal one, and all of that. But most folks don't pay any attention. And short of going to their houses and making them come to the Planning Commission and participate, we've struggled over the last 40 years with how to get people engaged locally where the decision should be made, where the issues are really present and on the table, versus holding up the process through an appellate loop that sometimes is simply because people are trying to figure out what did happen. I think when the proponents of the bill talked about some amendment language, I'd like to work with them on that. Maybe we can fix this a little bit to get a better way of notifying folks, make sure that people are actually told what's going on. There may be some procedural steps we could take at the local level to avoid a trip to LUBA and beyond that, the Court of Appeals in certain cases. Because I think it is important that we do have a system that functions well, and when you're going up on appeal, that's usually a sign that sometimes it's just legitimate disagreements and somebody wants to go argue about it. But oftentimes it's a reflection of the fact the system didn't function the way it's supposed to. With that, I will curtail my remarks. I did have a 45-minute PowerPoint presentation prepared, but I'll save that for a different hearing.
Dang,
look forward to working. I know, Mr. Chairman, it's a burden to everybody. But I will look forward to working with the parties going forward should the bill be continued. Thank you. Okay. Be happy to take questions.
Mr. Rendy.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee, and I got a little bit of a chest cold, and maybe I'll be able to get through this. I hope so. I provided you with some written testimony. I first of all want to apologize for the date. I have trouble with change, and I'll get the 2013. It usually takes me about 6-7 months for any year to get through that, and I'll get there at some point. I mostly wanted to be here because there's a portion of this bill that requires our department, the LCD, to evaluate goal one, which is a citizen involvement goal. And I want to make sure you understand that we have had quite a long and especially recent discussion about doing that. It is a very emotional, controversial issue. And we've had quite a few rounds back and forth with our Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee, a statutory appointed committee to look out for citizen involvement and advise LCDC on that. And the concern is that Goal 1 hasn't really changed in 30, maybe 40 years. And there are certainly provisions that are out of date, and there is a growing concern among citizen involvement advocates that it doesn't really work anymore, hasn't worked for quite a while, and it's getting worse through no fault of anybody except that local budgets are getting smaller and smaller. A lot of local governments have a hard time even supporting a planning department, let alone a lot of citizen involvement mechanisms that in good faith they adopted years ago and have been supporting in years past, but that's going away. So we are having that discussion, but at this point LCDC hasn't really opened up that goal for amendment, and I think we felt compelled to just point out to you that regardless of how you word this, if you ask us to consider such an amendment, that's a pretty big deal. To change a goal usually requires 10 hearings around the state. It's certainly something we will take seriously, but it is not a small exercise, and thus we have a fiscal on this bill, and we've made an estimate. It's the best we could do. If this thing gets really big, it could be small, but that's why that's there. But the other thing I just wanted to make sure that you are aware of is that we also have a major role
in looking at legislative plan amendments. It used to be that all of those came to LCDC. Now that's our assignment, to enforce all the goals, and maybe enforce is the wrong word, because most of what we do is work with local governments and try to help them understand these requirements and do things in a way that will prevent appeals. But in the end, we have to review these also, and we do look at almost every one of them. They come to us. It's mandatory that we get a notice of all of these amendments. In the process of notifying us, we see things in advance, and then again the statute requires that when it's finally adopted, we get all the materials that are adopted. So I was listening to some of the remarks earlier from Mr. Dewey, and I have to acknowledge that we have some of the same frustration. Things change really fast, and on legislative amendments, they're usually really big. So we have a lot of volume of a lot of material to look at. Sometimes we don't see it until it's done because it hasn't even been submitted to us. And so it is going to be difficult to craft the process in the legislative session that really makes sure everybody has a realistic chance to see things that are a concern and raise them locally. I think it's a great goal. We don't have any concerns with that goal as part of this bill. We recognize that it's really hard. Finally, I think you've seen us. You saw us last week, but we have some bills before you because we're concerned about the appeals process. We've had a work group commissioned for more than a year with the governor's office, trying to make the appeals process work better. And most of what you saw in 2254 is all about that. A lot of interest. We have a 50-person work group and a lot of a strong attempt to get consensus. We've examined a lot of appeals issues. This one did not come to us. I know there's a bit of irony there that we're now having to deal with that here. I think we could have dealt with it. I wished we had had a chance, but it was not raised to us. And thus, I think there are a whole lot of interests that may not even be here today that haven't been involved so far in considering what I think here is a pretty major change. And so if you take the suggestion that you've heard earlier that you look into trying to advance this, I hope you try to be as inclusive as we were and recognize that this is a hard problem that will involve a lot of interests.
Okay. In the interest of time, I'm not going to do any questions for you nice people because we've got a lot of people here on the other one that traveled a fair distance. So thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3040. Nope, sorry. 3362. House Bill 3362. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3040. And Representative Unger, you may or may not be able to get three people to happily leave the room if you want to talk about your amendment, because I don't think they care anymore. Do you want to do that real quickly and see if that works or not?
Yeah, so is it the dash one, I believe. Yeah, it is. The dash one amendment limits this bill only to solid waste disposal sites. And so anything else that's on this list, if you're here because you're concerned about anything else, there's a dash one amendment that hopefully people saw that limits this bill just to solid waste disposal sites, which is the amendment that I support when I take here to the committee today. Chair Clem, I thank you for allowing me to clarify that.
So you're welcome to still testify, but the two gravel and one what was it?
Spring water
bottling plant. If you don't want to, I think you're safe from any.
Okay. Today.
For today. Okay.
Here's so. Next.
So, I've got you sort of closing.
I think it might be best to have Mr. Miner come up first. He might be able to give a better introduction than I can. Although, I mean, I'd be happy to say that this is a this is my bill, Chair Clem, and the reason why I bring it forward is because there are, as we've talked about a number of times in this committee, a series of different permitted uses on EFU land. Some of them more appropriate for farming than others. One of them that seems particularly inappropriate for farming are dumps. It's
hard to do both at this on the same place, and it actually, you know, this is our 40th anniversary of land use planning, and I think that the fact that we try to set aside farmland to protect the agricultural industry, but then allowed us to permit landfills there, communicates some. I think, unfortunately, communicates the prioritization that we have for how important agriculture is. So I thought this was an important permitted use to take off of the list, and I hope that some of the testimony today will help persuade the committee to that effect.
Okay, now is Clark Ellingson here? Clark, okay. So I don't have you on that list, but I have you on another piece of paper, so I'm going to add you here. So why don't we start then with Jason Miner, Ilsa Pierce, Ramsey McDowell, and then we're going to need to go to the other side, which is, who's left here? Mike Dewey, Laura Liebrick, and I think that was Rich, but he got let go. So I think Mike and Laura will be next.
Brian?
There's somebody else who's here against. I may not know about you, so please flag it.
Yes. And I got a call from a Larry Morrison that he might be here to testify.
Is there a Larry Morrison here? All right, for or against? Or neutral?
Against.
Okay, then you're going to come up in the next group with the against, if that's okay with you. Mr. Morrison. Larry Morrison. Thank you. Thanks. Okay. So, Jason, you want to get us started?
Representative Clem, I have to learn your trick for making those three guys go away. That's come in handy for me.
The dash one.
Representative Clem, members of the committee, my name is Jason Miner. I'm the executive director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends is a nonprofit membership organization that works with Oregonians to support livable urban and rural communities, protect family farms and forests, and provide transportation and housing choices. Thanks for this opportunity to testify on HB 3040. HB 3040 is a tale of two land uses, farming and solid waste disposal sites. This bill protects exclusive farm use land, or EFU land, and agriculture, a growing industry in the state of Oregon, with a growing need for land from solid waste disposal sites, an industry which has no demonstrated need for land with class 1 or 2 soils, no demonstrated need for agricultural land, no demonstrated need for EFU land. Representative Unger was kind enough to indicate that I might give a background, and so I'm going to take those sections of my testimony that I drew a big X through and read at least a couple of them. In 1963, not quite when Peggy Lynch began advocating for public involvement, but at some point after, Representative Conger's reference to the beginning of the Western canon of law, in the early days of zoning and deferential tax treatment of farmland, EFU zoning contained only 6 uses that were non-farm uses. That list of non-farm uses has ballooned over the intervening 50 years and has grown in almost every legislative session. Today, the list of non-farm uses allowed in exclusive farm use zones approaches 50. And this session, you'll be hearing bills actually both about excluding some uses from that list and including new uses in that list. So the list goes on. The list has expanded over the years to be responsive to changing needs, but just as there are changing needs in land use law and in agriculture, other industries change as well, and I hope to touch on that. While some uses such as farm stands and wineries, things that you think are associated with agriculture generally, those are outright permitted uses by counties and are referred to as sub 1 uses because they appear in 215, 213 sub 1. There are other uses which are called conditional uses. Those appear in sub 2, and that's where we are today with solid waste landfills. A sub 2 use, a conditional use, a use that counties are allowed to evaluate for their impacts on agriculture. So solid waste disposal sites, the buildings, the facilities, the lagoons that can be associated with them are referred to as a sub 2 use or a conditional use, the second category of use, one of these ballooning list of uses. Now, farming is a critical industry in Oregon, and EFU land is the basis of that industry. The issue in this bill is the consumption of some of our best farmlands by a non-farm use. Agriculture is the number 2 economic sector in the state. It is responsible for 15% of the state's economy. It's responsible for 1 in 8 jobs in the state. currently one of the hot spots that we talk about in job creation in this building is traded sector industries. And I'd like to remind everyone that agriculture is a traded sector industry. 80% of our agricultural products go out of state. 40% of them travel internationally. And all of that commerce brings dollars back into our state to help build our economy. To my knowledge, solid waste is not a traded sector. Agricultural sales have grown relatively steadily over time, and very few other industry sectors in Oregon can say that. And that growth, that sale, that traded sector relies on the agricultural EFU land base. So Class 1 and 2 soils, EFU land, are critical to this economic engine. The dizzying array of produce that you see at a farmer's market, the dizzying array of high-value crops and seeds we're able to grow are all due to these lands, and we must protect them and have policies in place to protect these high-quality lands. Not only that, farming is a growing industry in Oregon. The past 2 years have shown a return to strength in Oregon agriculture with year-over-year growth in farm sales. The Oregon Department of Agriculture, in its report to you, in its 2011 State of Agriculture Report, lists the need to strengthen land use laws protecting farmland, stating, in quotes, other pressures on ag lands include energy siting and transmission, rural residential development, agri-mining, parks, and other non-farm uses. We urge the strong support by policymakers, that's all y'all, of agricultural land preservation for agricultural use. And ODA in that report, though I didn't pull out the quote, specifically cites the problem of cumulative impacts, the slow erosion bit by bit, even though some of these uses don't take up substantial amounts of land, the slow erosion bit by bit of EFU land undermines agricultural economies. By contrast, solid waste disposal does not currently have the need to grow onto farmland. The Department of Environmental Quality has reported in its 2011-2012 report to the legislature that there is sufficient landfill capacity in Oregon. Oregon has 27 operating municipal solid waste landfills. 90 landfills have closed in the past 2 decades as environmental requirements and landfills in the industry have evolved to require lining and require other approaches. Quoting DEQ from its report, many landfills that remain open are larger facilities that accept waste from regional rather than local areas. Some of these landfills are among the nation's largest, providing Oregon with sufficient disposal capacity for many years to come. Clearly, if we do not need more capacity, we do not need to site landfills on EFU land. Particularly concerning about this size of parcel issue is, as I said, industry has evolved over 40 years, farming has evolved over 40 years, and land use law has evolved over 40 years. One of our techniques for protecting agricultural land in Oregon was to protect large parcels. And that was one of the fundamental elements of the 1973 Senate Bill 100. But as we protected large parcels, I am concerned that we have protected something that is a fundamental target for landfills as they are getting larger, as the model is moving to transfer stations and larger facilities. Yeah. Suddenly, the parcels that we protected for agriculture, by virtue of their being large, become better targets for landfill siting. Oregon continues to receive significant amounts of landfill-bound waste generated from outside of the state. In 2011, also according to DEQ, about 36% of the waste disposed of in Oregon's municipal solid waste facilities was from outside the state. And that's at the same time that our per capita solid waste production inside the state has been decreasing. Since 2007, our individual per capita waste solid waste production as Oregonians has been going down, with technology recycling and composting increasing the generation of things that don't go to landfills. So it is, I think it's an unfortunate situation that as we have decreased our own solid waste production, we are in a situation where we are dedicating an Oregon asset, EFU land, to the solid waste production of others. According to my conversations with DEQ staff, DEQ does not specifically track the underlying zoning of solid waste facilities, so there's no easy database to figure out how many there are or what the acreage is. My own cursory review of DEQ permits in the past couple of days, permits associated with 27 municipal solid waste facilities and a random subset of about 66 that I looked at, show that about half of them were outside on EFU land. And I just want to state that eliminating solid waste landfills as a conditional use on EFU will not eliminate solid waste landfills. As I stated, there's existing capacity and there are other land use zones that can accommodate the industry. But eliminating EFU land does threaten agricultural economies in the state. So for that, I want to say thank you for considering this testimony, and I urge you to support HB 3040.
Thank you, Ilsa.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come speak. It's been years and years that several of us in Yamhill County have been working almost on a full-time basis to deal with an ever-growing landfill blight on our landscape, and we'd always hoped we could get it to Salem, and here we are. So I appreciate everybody's interest in this topic. The landfills destroy land, and they create mountains of garbage. To call it a landfill is kind of an oxymoron.
Excuse me. For the record, would you just introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm sorry. My name is Ilsa Peirce, and currently I'm president of a group called Stop the Dump Coalition. We used to be Waste Not of Yamhill County. We call it a coalition because we're made up of the Yamhill County Farm Bureau, the Soil Water Conservation District, the Willamette Valley Winery Association, and almost every farmer in Yamhill County who's been approached has joined us, along with many, many of the downtown businesses in McMinnville, and lots of individual farmers as well. So what I wanted to, you know, just look at the term landfill. It's a pretty old-fashioned term. We're not filling anything. We are making mountains. We are making mountains of garbage that will never go away. They will never support orchards. You can't grow anything on them because they're covered with a plastic cap, which can't sustain roots growing into it. They'll just be big, tall, molten piles of ooze that will create leachate and methane for decades. And we are concerned, especially in Yamhill County, about a landfill that is growing on in an extremely dangerous seismic hazard zone. But that's another topic. What we're really wondering about is the backward notion that we can just keep dumping garbage. The idea that garbage is going to just be something we are privileged to keep throwing around is crazy. So what I've tried to express in a written testimony to you is it's sort of specific to Riverbend, but it in the landfill in Yamhill County, but it is really emblematic of the entire industry in the state of Oregon. There are amazing alternatives to building mountains of garbage. There is an industry that is widely established, especially in Europe, where they do not have the land to just throw garbage on the landscape. And the fact that Oregon, which has been very forward in many issues for creating sustainable situations, the fact that Oregon is allowing garbage to come from all over the area to just be piled here forever seems a little bit ironic, because we shouldn't be doing something so primitive. All of you will probably have some photographs that I emailed to Representative Unger's office, and it shows some interesting befores and afters. It shows the landscape as it was 30 years ago, and now you can see there's a very, very large mountain. You can see filbert orchards that have a huge pile of garbage behind it. You can see how verdant and green the land is. In contrast, I have sent a picture of what the landfill in eastern Oregon looks like that is owned by Waste Management at Arlington. It's 10,000 acres of rangeland. There isn't a river nearby. There isn't an aquifer probably that is running underneath it. There isn't a large town 1 mile away. There aren't 500 surrounding farms. And one of the things that we're concerned about is that Waste Management owns 700 high-value farm acres around the landfill. The current law would allow them to cover all 700 acres with garbage, because it is a conditional use on farmland. They say they only want 60 more. When they see how much, they know how profitable it is to pile mountains of garbage on the landscape. It would be pretty appealing in 30 years to say, well, just 60 more. So they have the right under the law now to keep going. And I wouldn't be surprised if 60 acres was just the very beginning. What The community in Yamhill County has many other assets and does not need the economy of garbage. There are other parts of the state that are not blessed with some of the amazing things we have as far as agriculture, water, a thriving tourist industry, small manufacturing. There is a very high-end company that moved to McMinnville several years ago. The CFO of that company said to me, if we had come to Yamhill County and seen that pile of garbage, because 20 years ago that pile of garbage wasn't there, we wouldn't have come. It does not represent the kind of place where we want to do business. So I think that this bill is putting a pretty, it's putting things in perspective. This is not to say, oh, there are certain people who deserve garbage and we don't. There are certain places where, because of climate and because of the surrounding economy, a land, well, let's call it a mountain of garbage might work. It's very wet in our part of the state. In the eastern part of the state, the garbage deteriorates in a different way. It does not create the same amount of odor, and it does not create the same danger to a river that runs right by it. So when you think about this bill, I'm thinking of a specific place, but it also represents a problem in Oregon that is easily solved, because there is no shortage of places to put garbage. And the limiting of where you can put garbage will do what rising gasoline prices did to cars. It made people want more efficient cars. If we have fewer places to throw garbage, people will make less garbage. There will be an acceleration of very sophisticated recycling, repurposing industries, which create 10 jobs for every one job in a landfill. So I appreciate the time. I love to talk about garbage. I didn't realize that Jason Miner was such a garbage wonk. I'm really impressed. I thought there weren't too many of us around. And I would take any questions you might have about this topic.
Thank you. I think we'll go ahead and let Ramsey introduce himself and finish
Great.
The testimony.
Thank you for hearing me. For the record, I'm Ramsey McPhillips, and I'm a sixth-generation Oregon farmer. The last year, we just received from the governor a wonderful award for a sesquicentennial 150-year anniversary for our farm. Our family's been farming here pre-statehood. You've heard great testimony from these two, and I'm here to school you a little bit on the history of landfills. And I hope if you already know this information, or if I seem a little pedantic, that I apologize. But I just want to sort of tell you very quickly how we got here. You certainly know the history of landfilling, just burning it in your backyard. But what you may not know or have forgotten is that in the late 80s, there was a huge emergency crisis in the state of Oregon, in that the biggest metropolitan center, Portland and Washington, Clackamas, Multnomah County, was filling up their leaking St. John's landfill, and there was nowhere to put the garbage. And so this government body allocated $2.1 million to site a new regional facility to take care of all of the garbage in the Portland area. That lasted a very, very contentious set of hearings and meetings and legal proceedings, which cost the $2.1 million over the course of 2 years. And what they did is they found 180 sites. They then narrowed that down to 170, to 20 sites, to 10 sites, to 3 sites, to 2 sites, to 1 site. That took $2.1 million, and when they went down that escalation, the reason they were eliminating all of those sites was because they weren't satisfactory to put next to farms. Everywhere they found them in the three-county area, it was going to destroy agricultural land, either in the aquifer or the transportation or the businesses. And so they finally decided on one site. And in the middle of this court case, when there was a contested hearing with a Supreme Court judge and Metro wringing their hands because there was nowhere to put the garbage, along came a newly solvent, shall I say, corporation from Texas called Waste Management, who raised their hand and said, I don't know what you're all worried about. How about if we take care of all of those problems with putting landfills on farmland, you keep your farmland, we'll build you a giant mega dump in the desert on bad farmland, not near wetlands or an aquifer. It's right up the freeway. We'll build it for you, and you take all of that farmland and you farm on it and don't dump on it. They actually put ads in the Oregonian, full-page ads, waste management, saying don't destroy your farmland or the wetland. Let's build you these dumps. And that started this series, sort of hopscotch, of larger facilities up in the gorge, which then developed an incredible economy for a section of the state that was losing jobs. Now those counties up there, with these mega dumps that are taking garbage from Boise and Seattle and Portland, love garbage. The tipping fees, the jobs, the everything. There's no environmental complaints whatsoever. However, a couple dumps were sort of grandfathered in the valley, on the farmland. And these, the new regional landfills brought in these big corporations who saw other opportunities. So they started buying up these little mom-and-pop landfills in the valley, and those then, because of the RCRA requirements for updating landfills, had to spend a lot of money and became themselves regional landfills. The definition of a regional landfill in Oregon is 75,000 tons or more. So you can go up and down the valley and you see these regional landfills, which are on prime farmland without a need, because remember the need was taken care of with these giant regional landfills up in the gorge that have hundreds of years of permitted non-invasive landfill capacity. So the only reason that these landfills, these regional landfills still exist in the valley is because they're making business money, basically, for out-of-state corporations. Who are suffering because of this are certainly people such as myself, who is a farmer, along with all of my neighbors, who are losing our farmland and our ability to raise crops. Just this week, all of my goats lost their hair. So I called my vet, and I told him where I was living, and he said, well, it's the dump, isn't it? I said, what do you mean? He said, I've worked in your county for 30 years, and I can tell you that the agriculture and the livestock around that dump has a chronic health issue. So I called another vet. He wouldn't even come out. I called another vet. He came out and took tests. His first thing he said, I didn't bring this up, was, have you checked with the dump? So if you imagine the ghetto that is forming, not just the actual land of the landfill, but the buffer which they can't buy us out of, all these generational farmers unnecessarily, because once again, there is plenty of capacity up in the state. It's time that we change the laws to mirror the need. So you talk to DEQ constantly about these problems, and they're like, Ramsey, I agree with you. Had we known what we know today, we never would have sided the dumps on the west side for the reasons that Ilsa articulated to you. But the laws mandate that we allow them to go forward. We're stuck. We hate them as much as you do. We're very sorry that your fifth generation, sixth generation farm and all your neighbors are being destroyed. But we can't do anything. You, sorry, pointing, can do something. And I implore you at this point to advance the laws of this state to mirror the need. There is no need whatsoever to have lands on high value, or landfills on high value farmland anymore for business and commerce. And I'm sort of, because of the tragedy of losing my farm, I become a bit of a garbage savant. I can answer any question at another time from any of you about the economy of all this, of who will lose money, who will make money, who will be the winner and who will be the loser. And I can tell you, the winners are the farmers, the native Oregonians. The losers will be big corporations who already have their business in another locale. All the dumps on the farmland on the west side have a mirroring ownership of a regional landfill on the east side. So when you get rid of the dumps in the high-value farmland, the garbage is just going to be moved laterally to a less sensitive place. So I could go on and on, obviously. I think I've made my point, and I really, really appreciate that you're taking up this issue in this lecture. That means a lot to us.
Okay, thank you. In the interest of time, though, I'm not going to do any questions right now because there's some folks here who I want to make sure get to testify in case they have to leave at 5 o'clock. And so if you...
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Or Vice Chair, are you planning on moving these amendments today?
Maybe that would be a good idea so nobody else thinks
They should come back.
Well, then I would like an opportunity to ask questions.
Well, I don't. I have no reason about the amendments.
You don't have fiscal.
No. You can't.
Right, because you don't have fiscal back. Okay. This is one of the ones we don't have it back for.
Just for the record, the amendments are the only thing that are even in the possible universe. So if you're listening and you're not covered by the amendments, no reason to come down on this bill in the future.
So now we don't need to move the amendments.
So just to clarify, are we going to have a chance to have people back to ask those questions before we...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Same witnesses.
Were those three you're interested in? Yes?
I guess I have a couple of questions.
I just want to make sure the opponents get to testify, too. That's the only thing I'm really worried about. And if you can stay a little past 5, I can get them back.
I can stay
as
long as everybody else can stay.
Good. Okay, thank you. So I just want to make sure the folks who came in here who aren't here every day on the opposed to this bill side get a chance to talk. So Evan, are you against the bill? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't understand your amendment part of it. So, is there amendments being published that weren't out there?
There's some amendments on the website, but they basically limit the bill only to this landfill issue we're talking about now, and the other issue.
That's all the issue is going to be. That I'm not interested.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yes. Yeah. That's it. That's all we're going to talk about in the context of this bill. Just the landfill issue. Okay. And then, Mr. Morrison?
Yes.
Would you like to join us?
Yeah.
And then Mike and Laura, do you want to come up? And after that, I've got... still Katie Fast, Peter Kanegi, and Clark Ellingson, and then Rep Unger. So please, thank you for coming down.
My name is Larry Morrison. I'm 16710 Stellar Drive, Sherwood, Oregon. I own Morrison Trucking and Klamath Soil Amendments out of Crescent. I'm not exactly against Mr. Unger's bill in some aspects, but the way the laws are set up, we've been trying to establish a composting facility in Central Oregon. It falls under solid waste. The definition of solid waste is something that has no value. I mean, it's headed for the dump, period. The farmers in Central Oregon have come up with nutrient values of over $30 a ton out of compost. Composting on the west side here, as other people have already said, it's almost impossible. I mean, over where we trying to site our site at Crescent, we're talking about 12 inches of rain a year. North Plains, I think they got 61 inches. If you look up the EPA rules, one of the first things it says in there, composting has to be done in a dry, arid climate, which is the same thing as the dumps at Arlington, the Dalles. But with it being under that part of the solid waste, it shouldn't be. It needs to be segregated out because you are making a useful product that the farmers in Central Oregon want. Because at this point in time, we've been invited to come to a farm in Christmas Valley. Logistically, it's too far out. Because at our Crescent site, we backhaul pumice and chips, so we're able to transport the feedstock from Metro over there if we can get this established. So, but going all the way to Christmas Valley, they want it. The one farmer there that's invited us to come in, he's got 50,000 acres. On their crop rotation, they want 5 to 6 tons of compost per acre. The big hang-up still is when you start dealing with DEQ and solid waste, it's a heck of an ordeal. I've been at this for almost a year now at Crescent, and because of a bunch of screw-ups with two agencies between Klamath County and DEQ, as before, of not notifying the public properly on the permitting, we made it up within 4 days of having our Crescent site permitted. and because they didn't notify the Northern Klamath County people, and DEQ didn't notify them, it all blew up, and everything run out. Klamath County wouldn't give us an extension. DEQ did until the 1st of June. So now then we have to go back through Klamath County again and go through the whole thing. And I got a letter today. I haven't seen it yet. But there's like 17 people going to show up at a meeting next Tuesday to try and stop us from going in there. So it needs to be segregated out. Everybody over there thinks that it's a dump. Well, it's not a dump. You're making a product that has to be out of the dumps by 2020 anyway. That is part of the EPA rules. We're trying to eliminate part of the problems of the valley here because every composting site in the valley has the same problem. That's what I have to say about it.
Well, thank you for coming over. Did you come all the way from Crescent?
No, I live in Sherwood.
That's good. Yeah.
But I
thank you for participating anyway. Okay, Laura and then Mike.
Good afternoon, Chair Clem, members of the committee, and staff. For the record, my name is Laura Liebrich. I'm the Government Affairs Director for Oregon Refuge and Recycling Association. As you may know, ORA is a statewide trade association representing solid waste management companies in Oregon. ORA members collect and process most of Oregon's residential and commercial refuse and recyclables, as well as operate material recovery facilities, compost facilities, and many of Oregon's municipal solid waste transfer stations and landfills. In most communities across the state, ORA members do this work under the direction of and in partnership with city and county government. I received the -1 amendments to House Bill 3040 yesterday, and as I understand the amendments, the goal is to make it impossible to site solid waste disposal facilities in land zoned as exclusive farm use. Under environmental regulations, as well as land use law interpretation, solid waste disposal sites do include landfills, as well as waste-to-energy facilities, transfer stations, and compost operations. Since receiving the -1 yesterday, ORA has contacted its members that operate solid waste disposal facilities. While not a complete list at this time, facilities in the following counties in Oregon are currently operating on EFU-zoned land: Baker, Gillum, Harney, Marion, two facilities in Umatilla County, Wasco, Washington, and Yamhill. I expect there are more, and this list does not include any of the county-operated facilities. Excuse me. ORA is opposed to the -1 amendments. In the limited time available to review the amendments, they would appear to limit future operations of existing grandfathered facilities. I understand that the current facilities could continue to operate, but they would become non-conforming uses under land use law. ORA opposes this amendment because it would undo a long-standing and carefully considered provision of land use law and would do it precipitously without opportunity for full consideration of all of the unintended consequences. As one example, to prohibit the location of landfills in farm zones would have the effect of increasing pressure for placing landfills in other resource zones, forest land, for instance, and in industrial and commercial zones. This bill would eliminate the ability and authority of local communities to determine how they want to manage these types of facilities. The current law does not require solid waste disposal sites to be located in EFU zones. Rather, it allows local jurisdictions to make those decisions. If there are issues with any particular solid waste disposal facility, there are other ways to address those issues that would not require this type of legislative change. ORA and its members are always willing to have those conversations. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Okay, thank you. Mike.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey representing from some big bad waste management, think green. I reflect on Representative Unger's comment about 40 years of our land use system. I believe the first time I testified was in 1973 before the Senate Ag Committee, and it was on Senate Bill 100 for the Oregon Wheat Growers League. And I was terrified at the time. It's changed for me, thank God.
You're terrified, though.
Now, I've not seen the amendment, so this is the first gotten stuff of the session, I guess. I heard about it yesterday late, but I haven't seen it. I had asked our staff to find it. Perhaps it's on OLIS now, but I haven't seen it. So I sense that it basically would, in a minute I'll talk about Riverbend, because this is about the Riverbend landfill. Let's be intellectually honest about it. But Waste Management operates also a landfill in Gillam County, and there are certain agreements we'll talk about with Metro in terms of where the waste from Washington County would go, from the coast would go. But before I do that, I do want you to understand that the company Waste Management is the world's leading solid waste material management company, in literally in the world. We have a facility in Northeast Portland that is taking plastics that are destined for landfills that will go to energy, which is a fantastic diversion of our disposal space. We have a facility adjacent to our Gillam County landfill. It's called Inintech, and it's somewhat of a plasma facility, and it's designed to take the garbage, and it literally, it doesn't burn it. I understand it a little bit. It moves the molecules, so the equivalent of literally 20,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's in a beta project right now to get to where some of the proponents of this bill would like to go is, are there better ways to manage our waste? We're always going to need landfills, there's no question about that. But that takes then a syngas, and then also it creates blocks or building blocks for construction. So we're doing a number of different things to try and figure out a ways to divert waste from landfills, because it's a higher and better use. Also for the landfills, and with regard to Laura's client, we're a member of ORA. Both of our landfills create electricity through the methane, and we sell in the Gillam County landfill, Columbia Ridge, we sell electricity into the grid that goes into the Seattle market. And in Yamhill County, we sell it to the McMinnville Power and Light District. So there are some good things that come out of landfills. Just last year, we had with Yamhill County, and now this is Riverbend, they approved a five-year franchise, so we must be doing something okay if the county elected officials approve the franchise. And we also pay host fees, which are significant, which go into some very good projects into the community. Metro, you all know about Metro, and you deal with Metro with regard to land use planning and the like. Just late last year, Metro approved the non-system licenses so that the haulers can take the waste that they've collected from the transfer stations to the Yamhill County Riverbend landfill. In part, they did that because otherwise that waste is going to go to Gillam County up the gorge and through downtown Portland. Now, one of the things you need to know is a few years ago in Yamhill County, there was a referendum on whether or not to close the landfill, and the voters said no. So we've already had some discussion about what do the local officials have to say. Now, one of the things that we're doing right now is we have a berm permit, and it's contentious, and the people that spoke before you don't like it. And this is a permit that's taken us with DEQ at least over a year to work through. The costs are significant. I believe our regulatory system is set up, and perhaps it ought to be, to make sure there's a high threshold. But we now have a draft permit. But we've literally spent over $1 million providing all the information to get to this draft permit. So DEQ is very responsible when it comes to regulating landfills, and as best as I know, we don't have any violations in the arena in Yamhill County. Also, what we've done, so you get a sense of the perspective, is we have community meetings in the McMinnville or Newburgh area to talk about what we're doing at the landfill. And those are for people that are opposed to a landfill or not. We have a topic every month, and it's a discussion that's open, and I think the elected officials really like that we're having that communication. We also have a group of community leaders that are developing a master plan, because we have about 285 acres, and it's for what when the landfill closes, what do you do with this facility? You have opportunities for trails. You have opportunities for docks and the like. And part of this is also when we are still working on the landfill, there's going to be some improvements for the community. These are all good things that we're doing. Now, the issue in part for you is, and I think the opponents or the proponents of this bill talked about that, is where does the waste go if you close this landfill? Because I think it is about this landfill. Most of the waste is going to go up the gorge to Gillum County. So you're going to have more trucks going up the gorge. You're going to have a higher cost, and you're going to have the carbon footprint and the particulates that are involved in that. Now, this bill, again, was not on my radar screen in the sense that I didn't know about the gut and stuff, so I have some information that I can get to you as to the carbon footprint and the increased cost, because there will be a cost to the residents on the coast because of where garbage is going to go if a landfill closes, and there will be a cost for those in Washington County because they're in the metro district. So businesses, their cost of disposal will go up. You need to know that. And for residents, their cost will go up because the largest component of the system is disposal, in part because of the high regulatory burden. So those are things you, I think, need to know. Finally, I think what I want to say is that at the end of the day, there is no given that the Yamhill County Riverbend landfill will expand. At some point in time, we will come to the county and we will ask for an expansion, and that will be a permit application because it's conditional use presently, and there is no given that we will get a permit to expand. There is no given. It's a local decision. There will be community input. There will be appeals. Because we understand, as you know, it's very contentious in the land use system. Every decision we've made, or every decision a local government or DEQ has made, basically has been appealed. So there is plenty of input in this process. But I think you're going down the wrong path when you're trying to close one landfill and affecting all the other landfills. They're going to have to go somewhere, and there are certainly unintended consequences by having this bill go forward with this amendment. Thank you.
So we could do some questions, but I want to get the other panel back up here for questions. The problem is I have three more people who haven't got to talk at all yet. So my inclination would be, unless one of you has to leave right this second, just to take our last three. You do. But are you here regularly?
I need to testify, actually, in another energy committee? Environment. Yeah.
Why don't we go ahead and let you three go, and then we'll get the other three up here, and then we'll ask questions of whoever we want to, and summon you up one by one if
thank
that's
you.
The way
thanks.
To do it.
Thank you for your time.
Sure, can I just make a quick comment?
Yeah, sure.
I just want to make sure that it's for the record. Solid waste disposal sites were always a part of this bill, so while it's nice of Mr. Dewey to imply that this is the first gut and stuff bill of the session, I don't think it quite deserves that honor. It just simply narrows to landfills rather than replaces everything else with landfills. And I think that is actually important because this bill has been out there with this piece in it for quite some time. So for the record, I think that's important to note.
Okay. So Katie Fast, Peter Kanegi, and Clark Ellingson. And that is all I have signed up in this bill. Is there anybody else here on this bill? Oh, good. Okay.
Okay. I am going to keep my comments brief. Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I think we are in support of the concepts around the -1 amendments, but have not seen them. One suggestion I would have is that, and might resolve some of the conflicts that we're hearing, is to have it condensed to not allowing them on high-value farmland. And there are good definitions already in statute in 195 and 115 that could be referenced in drafting an amendment. Oregon has established farming zones, the EFU, to protect farmland, and we do believe that in many cases, landfills are not a consistent use with our land use planning zoning. Do recognize that there is a need to cite them, but would like to see, as this bill moves forward, an assurance of a protection of high-value farmland. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Peter?
Chair Clam, members of the committee, thanks for this opportunity. Again, like Katie, I'm going to keep my comments brief. Landfills are a necessary evil. There are appropriate places to site them, and there are inappropriate places to site them. And high-value farmland is definitely one of the inappropriate places.
I'm not sure I had you identify yourself.
Peter Kanagi, from Benton County. High-value farmland is just definitely one of those places where it is not appropriate to site landfills.
Thank you.
My name is Clark Ellingson. I'm from Yamhill County. I operate a 800-acre diversified farm adjacent to Riverbend Landfill. I've spent my entire adult life and my whole farming career working right next to it. What I came to talk to you today really is about the loss of farmland. Riverbend started out as a local landfill for the county. They started filling a river bottom, basically, that was irrigated farmland, grew row crops, a lot of corn. I think the farmer that originally allowed it to start there, he was under the impression that once that bottom land was filled up to the level of the upland, that it would be capped with topsoil and he could farm it again. But over time, ownership changed. It became a regional landfill. They moved into the uplands and started to build a mountain. The land under that, the type of land there is mostly woodburn soil. It's the best soil that we have here in Oregon for growing any type of crop you want to grow. It was irrigatable. It's easy access to the river. And so today, there's a 80-acre footprint of a mountain of garbage that's covering some of the best soil that we have here in Oregon. And as the lobbyist before me alluded to, eventually they'll want to expand on to another 60 or 70 acres of that same type of soil. Now, in my area, there is intense competition to lease, own, operate that type of land. It's the most sought-after land that we have here in Oregon. There's no doubt about it. My particular farm, I'm more towards the foothills. Only 20% of the land I own is as good a quality of soil as they're burying under garbage today. And so mainly that's the point that I wanted to make to you, that these landfills shouldn't be allowed to gobble up this super high-quality farmland that we have in some of these areas. Katie already mentioned to you, I think there is a split between low-value and high-value farmland. I'd like to see the bill maybe amended, to make it impossible to continue to fill over this top-quality farmland. Ilsa earlier had talked about some pictures, and I'm not sure whether the picture of my farm made it onto your computers, but it was the one that showed from 1990 to 2010, the change in the landscape, the house there, it was just a picture of farmland, and today, you know, there's a huge mountain behind that house. You know, I really, really following the lobbyists that came before me, my mind really began to race because I'd sure like to respond to some of the things that he said. You know, one of them is, you know, there is another landfill. It's called Coffin Butte, more down towards Corvallis. And you know, the truck traffic that travels through the small towns and McMinnville itself, you know, I'm guessing, but you know, you're talking about 60, 70 trucks a day coming through our area to go to that landfill, and that particular landfill, it's the bottom of it's below the water table. Originally, the way it was sited, it wasn't lined. You know, they are producing energy there, but they have to dewater it, so they're hauling water out of there practically as fast as they can haul the garbage in, because they have to dewater the gas collection system. But I've lost my train of thought. I don't want to bore y'all, but I have been in that area. I know the history. You know, the economic unit that they're covering with that garbage, many farmers would die to have, and waste management does. They own an additional, I think, 700 acres surrounding that that is mostly high-value farmland. And he alluded to a program that they're promoting where they've offered it out to the community to come up with whatever great idea they can to take this farmland and make hiking trails. This is farmland. It should remain farmland, whether it's covered with garbage or not. And one last thing is she brought it up, and it's been mentioned a couple of times. In the 80s, I did work on a ranch south of Arlington, Oregon, right next door to where Waste Management's landfill is today. And I know you don't all go back into the 80s, but the early 80s was an extremely trying time for agriculture. Farmers all over this nation were going broke, including those farmers, mostly the wheat farmers in that part of the country. And when they sited that landfill there, I'm going to tell you, it was largely positive there, because that county's got less than 3,000 people total, and many of them were looking for work. The landfill there, you're probably familiar with it, but it's built into a huge bluff. There isn't a neighbor. Even the ones that are nearby cannot see it unless they fly over it with an airplane. And this is an enormous landfill. You know, the complaint my rancher friend today is the amount of truck traffic and train traffic going in there. But smell, no. You know, sight, no. Conflicts with neighbors, no. Did they displace world-class farmland to put that landfill there? No, it was arid rangeland. So, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to go off. I'll you can ask me questions, but I'll stop now.
Okay, so why don't we do questions for this panel while they're here, and then we can ask questions any of the earlier testifiers after that. Anybody for this panel? Okay. Can we get the first three?
I guess I have some questions for some people.
First three. Yeah, you want to call them back up. Can the first panel come up? So Jason and Ilse.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Ramsey. Sorry about that, musical chairs. I just wanted to try and 3, 4, 5, which I didn't match, get everybody in. So, Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess probably, Jason, this may be directed towards you or anybody on the panel. I want to be clear that this bill the way I understood this bill before today, it did not, it wasn't going to do this. This amendment does this. Before, this bill only took out aggregate, the way the bill is written. So this is brand new that's before us today. So, but my question is, would you support the siting of incinerators like we have here in Marion County to burn garbage and produce energy in the same siting areas?
I will speak for myself, being part of a large coalition, and the answer to that is absolutely yes. That alternatives to landfills, that we're really only objecting to the large mass of land which is taken up to a landfill, the buffer zone necessary for almost every alternative to a landfill is so minor, and the systems today are so articulated, the cleaning systems for smokestacks, for the systems that Mr. Dewey was talking about up in the gorge, this gasification plant, it's a wonderful system. I'm very happy that it's happening up in the gorge. I wish them well. And the plastics to crude oil system, which is waste management has invested in, 6% of a landfill is plastic. If this state took all the plastic out of its waste stream and put it into his system, it would create hundreds of jobs. Riverbend Landfill, let's make this perfectly clear, is 20 jobs, just 20 jobs, and those jobs will laterally move with the garbage. They won't disappear.
Let me back to Jason. Would you support, in the particular areas where it's already sited, the generation of power by burning garbage? And my question would, I guess a follow-up to that, or two questions, is if we take this, if this bill passes, or these amendments are adopted, and this bill passes, would we be able to site those types of facilities here in the Willamette Valley in EFU?
My interpretation of the bill is the existing site wouldn't be threatened by the passage of this bill. The siting of new waste energy facilities does fall in solid waste disposal definition that's in DEQ's regulations, so it would be limited, eliminated from possibility of siting on EFU land. So the existing facility wouldn't be threatened. I think I've seen that one waste energy facility referenced in DEQ regs, but new siting of facilities like that on EFU land would be prevented because they fall in the definition of solid waste disposal facilities. Okay. DEQ's definition of solid waste disposal includes, I think there are 55 permitted compost facilities, about 140 transfer sites, 27 municipal landfills, and one waste energy facility that I'm aware of. So you hit the unique example. Great.
Thank you. I think that's a problem. That potential problem in the fact that that's one of those newer potential getting even better energy garbage facilities that we could put close, so we don't have to send trucks down the freeway and move this stuff.
That's the goal.
A complication with potentially with the way the bill is today. One other thing, Jason, you had mentioned the ballooning list of usages. Can you maybe school me a little bit on the history of the usages that you were referring to and when they got put in there? I'm kind of naive on that.
Vice Chair Cameron, I would might be the first time a Thousand Friends employee has been asked to actually elaborate more on testimony at a land use committee hearing. I can't. I can provide you references. I can follow up with the references that actually provide years that those individual uses were added. The balloon that I was referring to was six non-farm uses allowed in 1963, 10 years prior to the passage of Senate Bill 100. About 50 now. I can randomly pick some off that list. Some of the permitted as of right uses are berry seed washing facilities, berry processing, those kinds of things. Sub 2 uses are things like energy transfer stations, solid waste sites, those kinds of things where there you can expect that a county might want to condition those uses. That list is about 50. It's decreased. As I said, sort of stuff comes in and stuff goes out. Golf course is an example that most recently had been in and has gone out. Is that, and I can, I would like to follow up and have a
great
more detailed if that's
thanks
helpful.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
And I will give you what I think is this a accurate situation on what was in. Yeah. So the waste management section was not in the original bill. Wasn't affected. It just moved down a line. But the water bottling and the mining, geothermal, and then some of the other aggregate.
Yeah, my fault. I actually, we drafted the bill with it supposed to be in there, but I must have made a mistake.
So
I apologize.
Yeah, we're not
I
doing apologize anything today,
to you, Mike.
So.
I didn't mean to imply that you were trying to impugn my integrity in any way. That was not the distinction I was looking for.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. To follow up on Representative Cameron's question, as currently written, would this amendment prevent siting of compost facilities on EFU land, including non-high-value land that we see in eastern and central Oregon?
As currently written, it would. I think there, you know, one thing I didn't mention so much in my testimony because it was perhaps a little bit more of a pejorative thought is a lot of the ballooning uses that I referred to seem to be urban uses dumping on rural areas, stuff that comes out of urban areas or that urban areas need, externalities of urban areas, things like transfer state, things like energy utility siting stations, those kinds of things. Things that serve the urban area kind of being pushed off and put in rural areas. That's the sort of the category that I was putting solid waste landfill in. I think composting facilities can be fundamentally different. Often composting facilities are collections of rural material that is then composted in a rural area, and to me, I think that'd be an easy distinction to make. But in answer to your question, I think as currently written, compost facilities, because of the DEQ definition of solid waste, which
right.
I think somebody else had referred to, the gentleman with the composting operation in Sherwood and Crescent, compost isn't included, unless Ramsey is about to correct
no,
me.
Well, the state DEQ just promulgated new rules for the conversion technologies, including composting facilities, and this gentleman who is here now can sort of the problem with what he's going through is not good based on the confusion with where we can compost and where we can't, and that's an ongoing discussion, and that's not really is this bill yeah. articulates what we're hoping for, because
I wanted to jump in and address what Representative Cameron was asking about to clarify that some of the alternative technologies that are used in Europe are in downtown facilities. In downtown, in Spain, there is a city that has a plasma arc type of facility on a city block. We're not talking 20 acres, 10 acres, maybe 2 acres. So some of the alternative energy technologies that come from utilizing all the garbage are very different from making garbage to make methane. The garbage doesn't go away. So calling green energy from waste to energy piles of garbage is a little greenwashing. A pile of garbage makes methane. The garbage never goes away. There are technologies where the garbage, 70-80% of it, disappears and goes into something very beneficial and requires almost no space. So on the existing footprint of, say, Riverbend Landfill, there are probably places where, at the current size of the landfill, some kind of interesting alternative technology could be put without having to displace existing farmland. And you all should know that there are places around the world where they are, in fact, starting to mine landfills. You can get out all the metal. I mean, it sounds like a crazy job, but even the people, the executives at Waste Management, are talking about pulling stuff out of existing landfills. So there are lots of things there, but they're not giant facilities where with giant burning smokestacks.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair Cameron.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. Have you ever toured the facility
Brooks,
here in right. Brooks?
No.
The Brooks facility?
Yeah.
Small footprint.
Yeah. Right.
And that's, yeah.
But under this, the way this bill's written, we wouldn't be able to site those even in EFU land.
Do I smell a word?
I don't know. Any further questions for this panel? And then we'll get Mr. Dewey back up. Okay. All right. Thank you for hanging with us and coming back up. Appreciate that. Mike, you want to join us again? And
I'll just be real.
I have a question for you, too, so yeah. I was going to summon you anyway.
Mr. Chair, you want to go first?
Why don't you go ahead and
okay.
then let me...
Yeah, okay. Thank you. So the conversion technology rules that one of the previous witnesses spoke to, those are on hold. Those have not been promulgated by the DEQ, so I want to make sure everybody's clear about that. We did weigh in on that. With regard to greenwashing, it's an elaborate system to get the methane out of a landfill, particularly in eastern Oregon, because it's a drier landfill. So the garbage breaks down, takes longer for the garbage to break down. So the InInTech project I briefly spoke to is a beta project. It takes in about 25 tons of waste per day. And the conversation we've had with people at Metro is, how do we not take waste, which this bill would do, from Yamhill County or Portland to up the gorge eventually? Because quite frankly, if you're a company that's just in the landfill business, I would recommend you do not invest in that company, because we're doing a good job, more so than literally Washington, California, and Oregon are the leaders in material management, recycling, however you want to put it. But what we're trying to do is figure out a cost-effective way of keeping the garbage in the neighborhood. But there is a price tipping point where people will only pay so much for a new technology, number one. And number two, notwithstanding Representative Cameron, your question about whether or not the amendment would allow for something like Brooks or a higher and better technology, whatever that is, this InInTech. The question is, can you even permit that? And that's kind of, we've had that conversation with the Metro staff and counselors about, because these, and I'll talk about this in a minute, all these contracts at Metro come due. At one point, if you have a plan and you want to revolutionize what we do with our garbage and what we produce from it, electricity or whatever, you've got to be committed politically to go down that road. And I always question whether or not, knowing that I deal with clients that need to permit facilities, just because we want to do it doesn't mean you're going to get it done. And right now, that's why we have this facility over in eastern Oregon, because we could not have permitted it on the west side. We just don't think we could permit it. So what they're doing in Europe is great, and they can make it cost-effective. Their laws are a little bit different. Their ethic is different, and their cost component is different. But it has to be something that people are... The waste has to go somewhere, and then it's managed, and the question is, how do you best manage it? And that's what we're working on. But we still need landfills. The last point I wanted to make is that... And this is somewhat complicated, but the discussion Metro counselors had about this is, what is this going to do to the environment because of all the trucks? And I'll get you the number, because Metro did a study of how many more trucks are going to go up the gorge. They're not going to Coffin Butte Corvallis if the Yamhill County Riverbend landfill closes. They're not going there, based on the Metro contract. And that is a contract that cannot be broken. So for until the end of 2019, that's where these trucks will go. So everybody needs to know that. So by virtue of passing this bill, you are having, like it or not, a rate increase for certain people in the state of Oregon in terms of their garbage bill. That is going to be the net effect of that.
So that's what I wanted to ask you about. I have got a little, kind of forgotten how non-conforming uses work in these commercial type activities. So if we delete something out of the allowable use in the EFU, but it exists already, in residential terms, it becomes a non-conforming use and it can exist. But I don't actually recall, and if you don't know, that's okay. Somebody will, or we can get somebody in here. I don't know that it would close down an existing landfill I think what you said is basically it would cause the landfill to have to stop operations, the current one. Now, I know expansion issues are different, but the current one. But I don't think removing it as an allowed use in EFU would do that, you know, to the existing operation, unless it's basically full now and it's only the expansion.
Well, here's where we are, and the committee needs to be perfectly clear what the circumstances are. So for the last year and a half, we've been engaged with DEQ with a permit to establish a berm, and we have an agreement with the county, the five-year agreement, so they're copacetic to what we're doing. So this would allow us to be able to, and we're not increasing the height of the landfill. We have an agreement with the commission that that's not going to happen. So there's been some sort of subtle reference to that. That is not going to happen under our agreement. So we do this around the country. And so we're developing this berm for approximately, if we get the permit, and there's not a guarantee we're going to get a permit, that would allow for approximately 2 more years of capacity for the landfill. And then we move on to having to expand the landfill. And that's the land use process that we go through. That's the local process. And I don't think it's appropriate for this legislature to say we ought to close this landfill, because I understand.
Well, let me just interrupt, because I want to make sure we're using the right legal language here. Closing a landfill would be taking it out of an allowed use and somehow legislating, ordering the existing one to be closed. I think what you're describing is we'd be closing any expansion of the landfill.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, but not the existing one, except that it's almost at capacity, it sounds like. I didn't know that. I had no agenda for asking you the question. I'm just literally...
That's the
reality.
That's why there's... And trust me, because of the way I was reading the bill, I was not planning on having anybody come here to say who like the businesses that like having the landfill.
Sure.
The community that likes the landfill, who we've engaged. So there are, notwithstanding what some people have said, not everybody is opposed to the landfill. There was a referendum on this issue, and the public, Yamhill County, said, no, we want to keep this landfill open. But, yes, that's an issue. Now, I think there are some technical issues for other landfills, for example, Coffin Butte. I mean, I don't know what their situation is in Corvallis. And then when the transfer station part is problematic in the language, from what I understand, what the definition of solid waste is.
Do you know if all the expansion-owned areas also what the Farm Bureau would have termed high-value farmland when they talked, or do you know about that?
I don't. I don't know exactly.
Riverbend?
Yeah.
No, for the others,
okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, I think that's my questions.
Representative Munger?
Yeah, you can close, too, if you don't have questions.
I just wanted to first say I really do apologize to the committee and to Mike and his colleagues. I actually feel really bad. I'm kind of embarrassed, and so I'll say that I did not mean at all to surprise you with this amendment. I did actually think it was in the original bill. So, for what it's
I've
worth,
I've been surprised many times.
but sometimes it's on purpose. And you know, if I'm going to surprise people, I'd like to do it on purpose rather than on accident. So, I feel bad, and hopefully everyone on the committee too accepts my apologies. I shouldn't have been so confident in them to be so wrong. It's kind of embarrassing. So, but there's my mea culpa. A question to you though about the referendum that you keep on referring to. It sounds like that was a referendum whether or not to close the current landfill. It wasn't. Didn't have anything to do about expansion of that landfill.
No, it did not.
Right.
Great. Thanks.
Other questions for Mike while we got him?
I need to get to the recycle center.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you for your time, everybody.
And then I'll carry over the work session on House Bill 2746. We didn't have it up for people to take a good look at. And so let me carry. Well, first let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3040.
Yes.
And then carry over the work session on House Bill 2746. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you for staying an extra half an hour. I wasn't anticipating the first bill to go quite so long, but it's my bad committee management on my part. Thank you. Adjourn the committee.